Senator Hess will please come to order. Let the record show those that are present. And would you please add, Danny, as you see him come in, without me having to make a remark, Senator Sturzaluski is not in town today and is excused. Today we have Department of Corrections, and we're looking forward to hearing from you. Roger, would you like us to hold questions till you finished, or what plan of operation would you prefer?
I could, Madam Chair. I'd like to do an overview, and then I'd welcome questions.
Very well. Mr. Dell.
Prepared a few remarks here to keep me on track, and then perhaps with your indulgence, I could move to a couple of charts here to help make a point or two. But to start with, Alaska's prisoners' population has doubled in approximately a two-year period. In January of 1982, there were 1,069 incarcerated prisoners within the state correctional system, and now there are approximately 2,100. So it's escalated at a very rapid pace. All the projections that we have indicate that the present trend will continue. More precisely, it would not be unreasonable to assume that Alaska's prisoners' population will continue to double every 2 to 3 years, and that this level of increase will require very flexible and imaginative forms of management and significant increases in resources. A total of 800 new beds have been added to the state correctional system over the past 24 months, with 600 of those approximately being built in institutions, and up to 200 beds are now available in halfway houses. With a present capacity in-state of 1,684 beds and the addition of 602 new beds over the next 24 months, the state of Alaska will barely be able to adequately house its 1988 prison population, and only if all current facilities remain online and there is no increase above the current incarceration rates. So our problem really is a reflection of the tremendous increases in inmates coming into the system. Our budget is driven by the increase in the number of offenders. As I've said, we have roughly 2,100 people incarcerated. We also have just over 2,100 who are on probation parole status. So that's over, 4,215 people that we're supervising now statewide. 183 of those people are in the Federal Bureau of Prison System. The rest are in state. It used to be, and I'll go to the chart here in a few moments, it used to be that half the number of people on probation or parole were incarcerated. Now they're nearly equal. So there has been changes in sentencing practices, obviously in the provisions of the sentencing provisions of the new criminal code, which went into effect in 1980. Presumptive and mandatory sentencing all have had a tremendous impact on the correctional system. Unfortunately, we're at the end of this assembly line called the criminal justice system, and so we are the ones, unfortunately, who come forward with the bill, and that is a very costly bill. I'll show again here in a moment a chart that reflects the tremendous increases that have taken place in the last two sessions plus this one, reflecting the assistance given to us by both the administrative and legislative branches. But that assistance will have to continue, and that's where things get very difficult. So we've added institutional beds at the same time that we've increased our halfway house bed capacity, but the prisoners are coming in at a rate of 25 a month over releases. That translates to 300 new bodies a year, which really means 300 new beds each year have to be added to the system in order to keep up. Now, we've been able to do this so far in the past 24 months by picking up two surplus or former military sites, one at Wildwood at Kenai, the other one at Goose Bay near Wasilla. We've also added on to our existing facilities with modifications to Juneau, Fairbanks, the Cook Inlet pretrial facility in downtown Anchorage, which was opened about 18 months ago. Built originally designed to hold 180, will within the next 60 days have nearly 400. But we've done that through double bunking, adding new stairways to satisfy the fire marshal, and it's about $1.5 million addition. That addition will complete all the additions that can be made to that facility because we've used up all the land available there. So we do have plans to build, or to bring online, I should say, several other institutions. The Wildwood pretrial facility, we hope to dedicate about the 11th next month, move offenders into it. That will give us a pretrial capacity for the entire Kenai Peninsula, since there's a Superior Court there. That will work very nicely, we think. Also, it will relieve the city of Kenai from having to maintain a jail, so it works to law enforcement's advantage as well. The major Building 10 facility we have there will hold roughly 200 prisoners, and we are renovating most of that facility with inmate labor. The same thing is nearly true at Goose Bay, which was a former Nike military site. Most of the renovations there have been done with inmate labor, with contracts for technical expertise, such as furnaces and special skills, which we don't have, which have been done by the private sector. That facility will hold 108 offenders and should open within the next 30 days. Beyond that, the next major facility to open will be in Nome, which will open next September. It's really a replacement facility for the old territorial jail. It should only hold about 20. The new one will hold at least 88 and will be a regional facility. I skipped the Yukon-Kuskokwim Correctional Center at Bethel, which we were able to design, construct, and move into in 18 months. And the logistics there were phenomenal, but we managed to get all of the parts of state government to work well together on that project, so it worked. That was built to hold 72. It has 90 in it, and no sign of decrease there either. So the problem just continues. Well, anyway, beyond Nome, the next facility to open would be the following September, and that would be a Matsu pretrial facility in downtown Palmer, and that would hold roughly 62. And that's really an institution that will be coming online a little late, but it nevertheless will satisfy for some time into the future the burgeoning population growth in the Matsu Valley. Now those prisoners are being transported daily back and forth between Anchorage and the Valley. So that will also help the courts, the troopers, the city police, as well as our own operations. Palmer, by the way, represents, and Wildwood to some degree, represents an effort to try to consolidate the criminal justice elements in one geographic area as best we can. And I hope that in the future we can do more of that, because it certainly cuts expenses. 90% of our budget request, or actual budget, is related to adult confinement. This 4% of it goes to administration and support. This 5% goes to probation and parole activities, and a half percentage that maintains the parole board. Our budget has grown tremendously, but as I said, I think that reflects the recognition of the problem that corrections has had. As I'm sure you're aware, Executive Order 55 passed last year created the new department, and it really enabled us to develop and seek out, I guess, the resources to make our department a little more efficient and be able to cope with some of these problems. I can now pick up the phone, for example, and call one of my other fellow commissioners to resolve some major problems. So it has helped tremendously. We have a commutation plan in place by administrative order, which allows us, under emergency overcrowding conditions, to periodically release prisoners. And we have one of those in a countdown situation right now. We expect that something like 100 names will be submitted to the parole board in the next 2 weeks. They will review those names and recommend a list of commutation releases to the governor's office for review. Past practice indicates that very few of those people actually get released, so the impact is not terribly helpful to us, but it does release a few people from critically needed beds. Right now, statewide, we're approximately 150 people over capacity within the state, and that's why we're having this commutation countdown. In terms of legislation, I would hope that some of this legislation will reach this committee, hopefully this session. I understand that the legislation's, I guess, all been introduced on the House side for whatever reason, but there is a rewrite of Title 33, which are the bulk of the correctional statutes. that was an effort we initiated two sessions back. It didn't get anywhere for various reasons. However, I think now that the time is right to pursue implementing this rewrite of Title 33. Most of it is cleanup kind of wording. There are a couple of controversial and I hope very helpful issues in it, however. One of them would give the commissioner authority to contract with the private sector to hold misdemeanors, which we think can be done at much lower cost than maintaining them in our present correctional beds. It costs roughly $85 a day to maintain prisoners in a state institution. That's a statewide average. It varies by actual location, but on an average, $85 a day. It costs approximately $45 a day to keep a person in a halfway house, and $3 a day to supervise them on probation or parole. So quite clearly, one of the things we should be doing is looking for ways for less costly supervision, for the least costly supervision of these inmates, and save our costly bed space for the more serious offender. You'll also, I hope, be seeing a sunset review piece of legislation about the parole board to maintain and continue the actions of the parole board. I don't know that there's anything particularly controversial there. It's merely sunset review. And there also is a third bill on time computation. We now have three separate systems of time computations which we have to utilize to compute good time, which is awarded to prisoners. And depending on when the prisoner was sentenced, that determines which time computation. We need to go back in and clean that up, have one system which would be fair across the board. And that would be very helpful to us. Also, I don't think terribly controversial and certainly very helpful to us. In terms of crowding, in terms of problems, clearly overcrowding is our major problem. The Cleary decision is about to come down, should be out before the middle of February. Judge Cerdaley is writing that opinion now. In case you're not familiar with it, Cleary is a major class action suit brought by the inmates against the state of Alaska claiming that our correctional system is unconstitutional. It's a case which this administration inherited, but basically the issues in it are overcrowding and the quality and quantity of programs provided to the inmate population. Let me just move to a couple of these charts, and then I'm glad to answer your questions. Sometimes these things make a point but more easily understood. This chart represents the number of people in the black bar. It represents the number of people in institutions starting with 1974. The red bar indicates the number of people on probation or parole. And as you can see, back in 74, there were, well, not quite twice as many, but a great deal more on probation and parole than there were in the institutions. We had 488 people in 1974 incarcerated. What happens about 1980, when the new criminal code goes into effect, there is a time lag before these people start coming in. But then they did start coming in, and about 82 until now, this escalates dramatically. The number of people coming into the prison system has gone up tremendously, but complicating this somewhat is that those who are coming in are also staying much longer. So not only are we getting 300 new people a year, fresh bodies coming in, but the people who are already in the system are staying. So we've got an escalating problem. And this, we've revised this chart several times. It keeps going up. If this were a profit statement, we'd be in good shape. So we do have a problem. Probation parolees are going down. Only about half of our prisoner population are eligible for parole, because it resulted in mandatory sentencing. This has changed somewhat since last year, since the pasted on policy. It was 85% felons and 15% misdemeanors. It's changed somewhat. The press is still in the felony population. This statistic has hardly changed in 10 years. The ratios of felons to misdemeanors has not changed a great deal. What has changed, the actual numbers, they've escalated tremendously. This chart gives you a little more information about who these people are and in what categories. So, for instance, people in Alaska, in-state institutions, 1980, 663, 1984, 1714, this entire time, too. This was done a little while back. But clearly, percentage of change is over in this column
are tremendous. And they profile, breaks it down into sentenced and unsentenced felons, sentenced and unsentenced misdemeanors. But if you'll notice, sentenced misdemeanors have gone up tremendously. This is where we're receiving the impact of the drunk driving statutes. We have, you have to help me here, 150, I think, drunk drivers at any one time?
A little less than that, yeah.
Okay. We're actually, I hate to admit this, but we're actually reserving jail space in advance, like we would in a hotel, in order to take these drunk drivers in if we have no space for them. There's actually a 30-60 day delay on booking prisoners in to serve that mandatory 3 days. We don't have any option. So this isn't helping the courts much, and if you believe in deterrence as meaning that quick response, quick punishment, quick sanction being applied in order to deter crime, clearly we're not meeting that standard. So anyway, yearly averages showing felons, misdemeanors, sentenced, and unsentenced. It's terrible to appear before a legislative committee with doom and gloom, but I'm afraid that the facts really do speak for themselves. This shows our efforts in trying to cope with beds. Now, these are beds, not inmates. You can see, if you just look at the bottom line here, all of these institutions are listed, and our efforts to try to bring new beds online by certain dates. The beds that we have brought online, as I said, for a state this size, it's really phenomenal that we've added 800 beds in roughly 2 years, well, exactly 2 years, and plan to build 600 more in the same time period next 24 months. I compared, by the way, I heard Commissioner Noddy give some new statistics for the statewide population is something like 535,000 people. So when I went back to my office after the cabinet meeting, I grabbed my directory of American Correctional Association. We just passed Wyoming in terms of statewide population, so I looked at their felony population. They don't handle misdemeanors and others, but they have 700 felons in their correctional system. We have over 1,000 felons in ours. So just by doing some of these interesting little comparisons, it gives you a picture. We rank now 7th in the nation in our incarceration rate. We incarcerate 263 people per 100,000 in our population. So of the 50 states, we're clearly in the top 10. This is new beds to be added. Again, same sort of thing as the other chart, but this information will all be available to our annual report, which should be out next month, and it will give all kinds of statistics and have charts so that everyone can see where we stand. This little chart is somewhat controversial, of course, but it shows the overtime hours. When I first took office, Corrections was spending $250,000 a month in overtime for our correctional staff statewide. And you can see back in 80, it's a little bit difficult to interpret because, well, these represent hours, not money. So the number of hours has gone up considerably, as might be reflected with the increases in the inmate population. And what we've done here in this past year is try to get a handle on this and begin lowering that. And it is coming down, and we'll drive it down as far as we can. But it is a problem in that there's always the question, which is wiser, to pay additional overtime to the existing staff or to hire more staff? And to be quite frank, there's been several people study this, and it's sort of a 50-50 situation. We're not sure which is better. It's better for us in terms of staff stress and morale and having additional resources to have additional bodies, because the overtime situation is a stressful kind of situation you have to deal with. And this shows, finally, the growth in the budget and in the number of personnel that we have in the department. From 57.8 million in fiscal year 84 to the new budget request that will be before the legislature now, 79, up slightly from last year. So that's a very quick overview, but essentially it's all being driven by the information on that chart. So with that, I'll stop. I have some staff here which I can introduce, and if you have to answer any questions you might have.
I think perhaps we best meet the staff for those that haven't met them or new.
Okay. Let me start over here. Bill Lafferty is Deputy Commissioner for Administration. Bill handles all the personnel, budget, fiscal kind of preparation. He's based here in Anchorage. This is
Susan Humphrey Barnett, front row, handles our statewide programs, all institutional and field service programs. Cindy Nelson, kind of back in a light suit, is a special assistant here in Juneau, and Debbie Hanks is my secretary. Now, I have three regional directors who are not here. They're all out in the field keeping things in order. They will be here to present their budgets before the subcommittees who handle our budget. And Art Schmidt, who's the deputy commissioner for operations, he's based in Anchorage. He's the guy who keeps the day-to-day business flowing in a proper direction. So I think you have copies of our organization chart, which kind of explains the regional structure.
Do the members have questions or comments?
Yes.
Senator?
Thank you. Commissioner, I don't believe you mentioned the Seward facility, did you?
That's correct. I'm not sure where we're going to go with that Seward facility. Obviously, we have the design for it. It will be completed next month. The drawings down to where every door handle goes and so on, it will be completed. The ground has been cleared and graded. We are all set for construction to commence this spring. What we don't know is the amount of money that will be available for us to construct. We have roughly $19 million already in the bank, appropriated by past legislators. In order to complete the project for a 320-bed facility, I need an additional $22 million. The governor has concluded that because of the declining revenue picture, he has approved our request for $10 million. We therefore estimate that will build us 128 of the 320 beds, plus the administrative support building that has to go with it. So what we have in mind, should the $10 million request be approved, is that we will build the administrative support building and 128-bed, what's called a double housing unit, and then we would add the three other housing units as resources become available in future years.
Well, why would you get 128 beds out of 29 million and then have 20 and need 22 million more to go to the other increment? You see what I mean? It would seem like your per bed cost is much higher in this.
It is, mainly because the support facilities have to be built first. They have to be built. If you house any prisoners there, we have to have all the support facilities to go with it. That's why the initial beds will be tremendously expensive. It's only when you complete it at the 320-bed level that those costs come down.
Has there been any development which has shot those costs up since we last talked about it in 84?
No, not really. It comes out to about 100. When you use only the construction dollars, which I understand is the appropriate amount to use in computing this cost, it comes out to $100,000 per bed. 320 beds at $32 million, roughly.
Well, what was the estimate before the Senate in 1984 for the 320 beds?
It was approximately 36, 37 million. Now, again, that's construction dollars. It does not include architectural engineering fees, ground clearing, and any other related things to get the project ready.
Because it... I see. So it would be like, the difference would be between $36 million and $40 million is what you're saying.
Roughly, yes.
I had heard that there were some problems about electric utility connections down there. I don't know if it was a right-of-way acquisition problem or a difficulty with the utility company. What is that all about?
As I understand it, the only problem is that Seward has, well, since they brought on their coal development project and their boat lift project, they have tremendous needs for electricity. And I understand that initially when they turn on all that equipment to power dims in Seward, they evidently will have ample power, but they must put in some new transmission lines to the site. That's not an insurmountable problem, but I understand there would be some costs there. Also, the only other issue of a potential major concern is the sewer treatment plant, which we think we can share with the city of Seward in their port development. So whether we build it or Seward builds it, it would be a shared resource.
I may be anticipating Senator VanCamp in this, but this $100,000 per cell or per bed cost, given that this was a modular concept, is that an irreducible figure, or if you compare it to figures in the nation, do we have to always look at that as a rule of thumb?
No, the $100,000 figure is not unreasonable in Alaska prices for long-term high-security bed space. That cost per bed drops tremendously if you lower the security of the institution. For instance, you build a medium security institution, such as Wildwood, for example, which we refurbished, the bed cost there drops tremendously. And minimum space or halfway house space drops even further. But this is Alaska's first long-term high-security institution. It's concrete and steel. It is modular. We feel that we've saved about $35,000 to $40,000 a bed for the new design. Because, well, the design that I inherited when I came in, the costs were about $135,000 a bed.
Where will you be then? In terms of, I know you can't anticipate changes in law and. Maybe you can't anticipate the crime rate either, but with 128 beds instead of 320, where will that put the system, taking into account the other expansions you may mentioned?
Well, I predict, let's see, that could be online about 1987. I would say that by 1988 we'd have a real crisis.
Now, does the Cleary case possibly mandate more bed construction to alleviate overcrowding? Is that a...
Possibly, yes.
So before this session is over, we may have at least a trial judge's direction as to what, if any, beds are needed to satisfy constitutional criteria.
We're trying to guess and predict what the judge will say or rule on, and that's very hazardous. I expect, though, the major portion of the case deals with overcrowding. My guess would be that he would attempt to set caps or capacities for existing institutions. And when we exceed those capacities, we either let prisoners go or build more space.
Using the executive order authority that you mentioned as an example to emergency.
I wouldn't be surprised if the court ordered it, because they've done it in 35 other states. The 35 states right now whose correctional systems are under court mandates.
So the court could step in and order the release of X numbers of prisoners, or even decide who they're going to be, I guess, through a master.
Yeah, I don't know that they go that far, but yes, in theory, that's possible. Typically, what's happened in other states, Alabama, Oklahoma, many others, the courts have set capacities, and when the capacity is exceeded, the state is to determine who will be released, but they must be released until they fall back down again to that operating capacity.
Well, in Alabama, a federal judge actually was the Roger Endell of Alabama, isn't that right? Judge Johnson. Do you senators have questions? Senator Fisher?
Yes, thank you. Let's stay on the same sort of facility. Let's assume that Department of Revenue is right and we have to cut $500 million out of the budget. And let's assume that the capital budget goes to nilch. What would your plan be for the $19 million with no additional dollars?
Well, to be quite frank, I'm about to initiate discussions with the governor's office on that very issue. I don't have an answer for you right now, but clearly we must have an alternative. When I say we, I'm not just talking about the Department of Corrections. It's the state that has the problem. Whether I'm here or gone, the problem will still be here. We will have to find an alternative, because I don't believe the citizens of the state are going to be terribly patient with periodic releases of prisoners. What we're trying to do then is develop all the reasonable alternatives that we can come up with. So in the next few weeks, I hope that by the middle of next month we'll have a Sedaly decision and we'll have a better idea of what these revenue projections are, and then we'll know whether we must find some other alternative.
I have some other little questions, and you're going to be bored, maybe, because you know the answer, and he doesn't, but I know. When we talk about inmate gratuities, how are they arrived? I just happened to be looking through your budget, and I saw a request for $88,000 additional for inmate gratuity. What is that for?
That's the inmate wage scale. Okay. They're paid, it used to be a dollar a day. It's gone up somewhat.
but it's very inexpensive labor, and we use that to the state's advantage. There's a good example, I think we'll have it in our annual report. We had an estimate of something like $400,000 to re-roof one of our facilities. And we did it with inmate labor after sending one of our staff out to be certified as a roofer, and it cost $36,000. So we don't want to jeopardize the private sector employment situation, but on the other hand, we can save the state tremendous amounts of money. You just reminded me, by the way, that one of the other provisions that is in the Title 33 rewrite is that we've asked for authority, statutory authority, to be able to take on construction tasks up to, I think the wording is $100,000 in value. If the legislature should see fit, I'd welcome raising that to $500,000, even $1 million. But there are some statutory conflicts.
Another area, when you start looking at various budgets, everybody keeps talking about a standard vacancy factor of employees. What do you consider a standard vacancy factor within your department?
Can I defer that to Bill?
Okay, sure.
We don't have an in-house established attrition rate. We take what's imposed on us by the Office of Management and Budget, and that's derived it through it. Back in the old days, before the computer payroll calculation was simply a mathematical process, through negotiation with them, we've agreed to a 2% assumed vacancy factor at the institutional environment this year, or FY26.
Just one more and I'll quit. Also, where in your priority list was, I see you had requested a business manager, and looking over the flow chart, I see that probably you're handling that function, right? Is that still a high priority? Could you still justify a business manager within the correction systems, or is that pretty well taken care of?
The cut line made by the department included the business manager. It didn't make it in the governor's request column. Yes, if we're going to develop prison industries and follow through with the commissioner and administrative philosophy of inmate work, we have to have somebody out there to sell the product and find the markets for us, and that's the solution.
Okay, then you answer my question. It's if we get into the industrial aspect of the industry, what you would need this person for, not for existing business practices.
The answer to that is both. In fact, we do have four industry programs going right now. But at Wildwood, the Kenai facility is the next targeted institution to get into furniture manufacturing and repair. And so we need someone. And these people are in the production line or they're in the correctional line, but we don't have anybody to go out there and work with state offices or the private sector to develop and deliver goods and services.
Thanks.
A question on that. Could that be done cooperatively with the Department of Commerce?
Well, yes. I'm not sure what your question means. I mean, we work cooperatively with anybody.
Well, they have people out trying to work on marketing of crops. They have people out trying to work on marketing this, that, and the other. It seems to me like if there's a problem there that you don't get the funding you need, you can say, hey, you know, while you're out working on that, add to it this and see what you can do for us.
Yes, that would be possible.
Wouldn't be the best of all possible worlds,
right.
But then neither is $57 to $2 loss in income per barrel as of yesterday. You know, not the best of all possible worlds.
Sometimes some of these positions more than pay for themselves. For example, at Palmer, we grow between 100 and 130 tons of potatoes each year. Those potatoes then are delivered to our various institutions. And we're able to do that without jeopardizing the farmers in Palmer. They already can't produce enough for the market, so we're not in competition with them. We're doing body and fender work on state cars at the Palmer facility. And just the last 2 weeks, we opened up the bakery and laundry services for the Marine Highway Fleet right out here at this institution. all of which is saving money for the state. So the cost of the money that goes to the prisoners, by design, they're to be self-supporting industries, but it does take us a couple of years to get those industries up and well so that they are self-supporting. So a position like the one that you've asked about would more than pay for itself in a very short amount of time. I wish we had the time. I'd like to share with you a film I have in the Texas correctional system. It goes on for an hour, but it is a totally self-supporting system. There are no tax dollars from Texas that go into the correctional system. Now, of course, they have 36,000 inmates. They are literally building their own institutions. They farm their own crops. They're a self-supporting department. We're a long, long way from that level of expertise or ability. But we can do many things ourselves.
When I look at this $100,000 per bed, you know, it's mind-boggling. I know in some cases where we've been looking at the needs of community and the factor that's built in the architects or in the estimating of the cost of a facility, many times an arbitrary percentage of costs is added to that estimate or to that architect's work or whatever. And it's been found in instances, at least two people I know in a private and in a nonprofit situation, that's not necessarily the way it is now. You know, that we're using figures that were appropriate a couple of years ago, but not appropriate today. Has there been any investigation along that line, as far as your costs of $100,000 a bed? Do you have any doubt in your mind about what the bids will come in that high?
No, that's a difficult one to predict. What we have so far, the Nome project and the Wildwood pretrial project, both came in at or under the estimates. I'm trying to think if there are any other. Bethel came in right at the estimate. So we seem to be doing fairly well there.
Of course, in a situation where everybody knows how much is budgeted for a project, it's very difficult to have it come in very much under that project. But at least from information I've been getting from some of the private sector, it's always much more costly for the state to build than it is for a private enterprise to build. And I'm very apprehensive of that price tag being there for everyone to see and ever expecting to get very far below it.
I agree, Madam Chairman. I think there's some very serious problems when the state does build a project. The cost goes up very, very high. We proposed a year ago the possibility, or the potential, maybe I should say, of a private sector contract. For example, the Palmer pretrial facility, we received permission from the Department of Transportation to transfer the funds given to us by the legislature to the city of Palmer, and they are managing it. They have an excellent reputation at doing this kind of thing in the past. The overhead is very low, very reasonable, and they're going to deliver it on time to our specifications. Seward would be another possible location to do exactly that same kind of thing. It takes it out of the state's hands. It does put it into another governmental entity, but it gives us management control and the overhead costs drop.
I would think if we started offering those community percentages of the savings, they might drop even more.
I agree.
What was your testimony at the beginning about the shortfall at present of bed space design, or however you put it, to prison load?
Well, very simply, if in addition to the 800 beds that we brought online in the last 24 months, we plan to bring another 600 online in the next 24 months. If we are successful in doing that, we will barely be even with the inmate increases.
Now, that 600 includes how many in Seward?
Well, that was 320.
320.
That's no longer the case.
Is there a possibility that what you consider a bed space is going to be something Joe Cerdelli will consider overcrowding? I mean, his criteria and yours might be different.
I don't think so, because we testified a lot on that. I spent a lot of time on that issue. The courts have ruled across the country, even to the Supreme Court's level, that it is not unconstitutional to put a second man in a cell designed originally for one, so long as they have some freedom outside the cell. So I don't anticipate any difficulties there. We've double-bunked the entire cook inlet facility, or will have completed it very soon.
Well, let me put it this way. If you had the 320 spaces at Seward, on the overcrowding issue, you ought to win your case. Is that right?
Yes, if we had the facility.
Unless the judge got cranky and said, well, you're not doing it fast enough or something like
that. That's true. I mean, that's my guess. We're guessing what the judge will say. But yes, I think we presented substantial evidence to show that we would keep ahead of this thing if all went according to plan. The other thing that's worrisome here is that when I testified in the spring a year ago, we were really talking about a 640-bed facility at Seward. And through discussions with various legislators, it became apparent that that would be unacceptable and the cost would be too high. So then it became 320. Now that's unacceptable. Now it's 128.
Buckner Building looks better all the time.
Don't do that. Well,
I can't help feeling a great deal of responsibility for this, because we've been played such a major role in the changing our presumptive sentence and maintaining the prisoners for longer periods of time, sending more prisoners to the facilities. If the judge is ruling, just to play around here a bit, if the judge's ruling comes down not very favorable for us, and if the income to the state continues to drop at the rate it seems to do now, we're going to be way behind the eight ball. In those circumstances, would you be recommending any changes in statutes?
Well, my answer is yes, but I can only speak for the Department of Corrections, because I'm not sure that that opinion would be shared by my colleagues in other branches of the criminal justice system. As a matter of fact, I rather doubt that they would be. And to be fair to them, I do remember I was at the university when all of this was very much a very controversial time back in 78, 79, a Blue Ribbon Task Force was formed to pass a new criminal code, to formulate a new code. And the public was demanding that the state become tough on crime and criminals. And we did that. The criminal code itself is excellent. The statute is good. I mean, it's well formulated and so on. It's the sentencing provisions of the code that affect us. And where judges' discretion has been limited, we're feeling the crunch. From a little preliminary study, which we'll also have in our annual report, not terribly sophisticated, demands more work, but it appears to us that presumptively sentenced inmates are serving 30% to 40% more time than those not presumptively sentenced. And the bulk of our prisoners are long-term felons. So I think, to answer your question, I think there's a significant impact on our operations as well as cost to the state because of the sentencing provisions of the code. And in my talks to judges from Fairbanks to Anchorage to some here in the Southeast, they don't say so publicly, but they also have, they share some of those feelings. A judge in Fairbanks I talked to several times is, well, I think it's fair to say, upset because some of the people coming to before him on sexual offense or sexual abuse cases, if they're found guilty, have a mandatory 8-year sentence. This particular judge doesn't feel that that's right. He doesn't have the latitude to deal with the individual case. The attempt to equalize punishment or sanctions was good, but perhaps there's some dangers there too.
Let me ask you something. Since you brought up that in a violent sexual assault case, rape or along with beating, etc., The sentence is about, is 8-year mandatory, right?
Is that correct?
Now, in a situation of fondling, child abuse, sexual assault, that's also 8-year offense, right?
No, fondling would not be.
But there are lesser sexual
It goes
offenses.
By degrees of penetration, or not degree, whether or not there is penetration. And penetration is, carries the 8-year presumptive sentence.
And non-penetration has no presumptive sentence.
Madam Chair, but penetration does not necessarily mean penetration by a sexual organ.
Right.
From your statistics that you showed us, I remember when we were working on some of this legislation, it was supposed to help reduce crime, all this thing. Have you seen any indication of that type of result from the type of code that we have?
No. I can't say that our statistics show that any impact at all. And keeping, it's really a pattern that's in keeping with national level research, which some of our people here have evidently not paid close attention to. The argument is that the most effective form of punishment is quick and sure punishment, not the length of time. As a matter of fact, that may be more detrimental. In other words, people should be taken to court quickly, they should be tried and found, whatever, innocent or guilty, quickly, and punished quickly. But the length of the punishment should be effective. It is most effective if it's relatively reasonable. Now, that's where all kinds of folks can argue what's reasonable. But if you, the Supreme Court of this state has said several years ago that except for the most heinous types of crimes, most offenses, most sentences should be approximately 5 years or less. And I tend to agree with that. It seems to me, we used to laugh in this state a long time ago about Texas and their system of punishment where inmates would get 400, 500, 600 years. We now have prisoners serving exactly those kinds of sentences. I'm not sure that that's reasonable. I think maybe we've gone a little too far.
Well, we have sentences that can't possibly be served unless they're Methuselah. That sounds a little unreasonable to me.
Madam Chair, I told you I visited the correctional center in Palmer Sunday, and I went to see a young man who was convicted at age 18 of robbery in the first degree, and he was given a 7-year presumptive sentence. Problem is that there were 5 men involved, and the others all went before a different judge, presented mitigating factors, and all got either suspended sentences or the top was 3.5 years. And of course, his judge did not know what was in the other courtrooms. Those kinds of situations, he had no prior criminal record, even as a juvenile, no juvenile contacts or anything else. So he's sitting there in Palmer until 1987, unless something is done for him. That does seem to be too bad and harsh, and it's an interesting situation because there the presumptive sentencing idea of equity amongst defendants didn't work. One lawyer presented mitigating factors and the other didn't.
It's a very real problem, and well, as I started to say, some of my colleagues in the criminal justice system don't share my view, and they are reluctant to open this can of worms, as they call it, because back in the late 70s, the public was hostile, angry, because people were being let off. There was too much judicial discretion. Paroles were a little too easy, and so on. And they're worried about going back and opening that whole thing up again. I don't think we need to go to that extreme. I think what other states have done is form sentencing commissions. Many of them are composed of both legislative, well, all three branches of government representatives sit on a commission. They usually have a staff that does the day-to-day work. But they research the issue and come up with a series of recommendations. Minnesota has the best one that I know of, and I'm not an expert on it, but they literally annually balance out the populations and they adjust sentencing and their space in their prison system based on the recommendations of this ongoing sentencing commission. Something like that is not unreasonable. It's also not terribly expensive, and I think it would be very worthwhile. It certainly costs less than the multi-millions that we're going to be asking for.
There are many of the general public who were so involved emotionally. People are tired of crime on the street. People are tired of being afraid. And many of them, as I did, felt that, hey, you know, they tell us this is the answer, maybe it's the answer. But now I think disillusionment has set in. There's still crime on the street. They're still afraid. The priorities of our spending now, we're going to have to spend for corrections many times when they much prefer to see it in education, mental health, or whatever. And they're beginning to weigh those things. So I think I have a great deal of confidence in the general public when they're well-versed in the facts, that they make good decisions. And if I didn't, you know, I couldn't believe as strong as I do in our former government. But I think we're going to reach that point where we'll see the public again clamoring for us to do something that makes it more equitable from their pocketbook, if indeed they haven't gotten this safety they feel that they were going to achieve. Does that make any sense to anybody? Yeah. Does anybody else notice that in their constituents? I have. And so it bothers me that here we are facing such great decreases in income and such increasing costs in the correctional care. And just throw in with that, you know, the mental health lands lawsuit that we could or could not lose, the social programs that we're going to have to cut. And then people began to think, hey, you know, where are our priorities and what are our choices? So I'd be very interested in pursuing with you. I can't speak for the rest of the members of the committee because we haven't discussed it. But just taking a real good look at what our alternatives are when it comes to the factors that we're facing today.
I'd like to offer to come back and talk to this committee again in roughly 30 days, hopefully after the Sedalia decision and after we've had time to analyze the thing with the governor's people, and hopefully suggest some alternatives to you.
Unless there's objection from the committee, I think that would be a very good thing. Because I think that we have a responsibility to take a good look at this as we try to set our priorities. And some of those are going to be dictated, you know, by debt service, by requirements of the court. Take $700 million if we lose the mental health lands case. These kinds of things. We're going to have funds for running government and providing the services that people expect and deserve, you know, as well as the prisoners expect and deserve their rights. Anything else?
Yes, I, by the way, just had a meeting with an Anchorage official who came back from Washington, D.C. and predicted great cutbacks in federal programs of all kinds, for city governments and schools. One of the prisoners I talked to in Palmer was George Homan, and I asked him about the mixture of prisoners there in the minimum security facility at the correctional center. And he said that they were all kinds and that there were murderers there and others who had been convicted for violent crimes. How is it that they wind up in a minimal facility? What do they do to move themselves into that classification, if he's correct about that?
Well, basically, we evaluate and work with prisoners based on really two factors, their sentence and their behavior. And those are the two primary moving forces, I guess, in our decisions. But yes, most, if you'll permit me, laymen, they go into correctional operations, are sometimes shocked to see a murderer, for example, serving in a very low-key, low-risk sort of environment. But often, what that means is you have to understand the offense that the person committed. Often murderers, if I can exaggerate somewhat, the typical murderer is a crime of passion, a crime of opportunity, not one that's well thought out or planned, nor is it usually a mentally disturbed person. In this state, alcohol is almost always involved, and where someone gets killed. Put that person in a correctional environment, and it's very, very doubtful that we'll have any serious management problems with him. Probably will not ever commit a serious crime again. That's usually very difficult for folks who don't work in this business to understand. On the other hand, you take somebody who writes checks or the joyriding young person, 19, 20-year-old, who takes somebody's car, they often will require maximum security because they're very difficult to handle, to deal with.
So yes, the population at Palmer is mixed. It tends to be an older population, however. There's very few young people there. But they're very stable, and they get along very well. They work very hard. It's really a work-oriented environment there.
Senator.
Thank you. Commissioner, would you feel that the cost of the Wildwood facility was really a reasonable way to go, renovating an old building?
Yes, it's
compared to new.
It's been a lot of headaches, but yes, we don't. We have approximately $10 million into that facility. That's including the pretrial facility, which will, let's see, 262. It'll be close to 275 people, and there isn't any way that I could have built a 275 bed facility for $10 million. And in Goose Bay, it's even, we don't have 2 minutes, it'll be 100 people. So it's a very reasonable way to go.
I guess the follow-up question would be, have you looked at Mount Edgecombe facilities at all as a potential prison site?
I worked there several years ago, but no, I haven't looked at it lately.
The reason I bring that up, you had mentioned $85 a day for a, if it's not a serious type of confinement, the state runs it. Yet, Madam Chairman, the school that we're going to put in Mount Edgecombe is going to run us more than $85 a day for high school students. So with that in mind, maybe what we need, and I think my figures are right, just for trying to do some figuring, so maybe we ought to look at that as a prison facility instead of high school.
So I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. No way.
Madam Chair, if you'd like.
I support the chair.
If you'd like, Susan could share with you some of the programs. The Constitution mandates two things. One is protection of the public, and obviously prison beds and so on have to deal primarily with protection issues. But also it mandates reformation of offenders. We've had a significant effort to, in the last 2 years, to try to put together decent programs in all of the institutions. If you'd like, Susan can...
I would like very much to talk to Susan about that and see how the figures are on reformation these days. I would like to ask a couple of things first, though. Not off the hook yet, Roger.
Okay.
you mentioned a subject that's one of my pet peeves, and that's the joyriding situation. What's the situation now for joyriding? And I'm showing my ignorance on correction. But is that still not considered a theft? It's.
I don't believe it is. You've gotten now out of the element. Can you help me? I don't think we have many in that category who are in serving time.
Well, I don't think you do either, because I think a lot of them go joyriding and go again the next day, so I just...
Yeah.
I know that the Anchorage Police Department have recommended House Bill 17, I believe, that would address the problem regarding joyriding and changing the type of offense that it would be.
And here we go with more beds needed, right?
I'm sure.
Maybe if there's an offense to it, it'll stop some of it. It's rather difficult at 40 below to go out and get your car and somebody's decided to take joyride. It's, in my reading recently, there's I've read quite a bit about so-called crimes against property and the studies that have been done there on those crimes that are committed during, for instance, robberies, etc. Is the department at all involved in any of that type of research or looking into that, or is that out of your domain?
We'll be prepared. It's being put together now to show you the numbers. What we've done is taken a snapshot of everybody who's in the system now, and we'll be able to show you specifically how many are in for each kind of crime. So we can tell you how many are in for robbery 1, 2, and 3, and drug and sex offenses and all of that. But that's about all we can do. We can tell you who we receive.
Are there further questions?
The only comment that I would like to make is if there is a time when you do have that film on Texas, that you're going to show, I would appreciate it if you let my office know. We may not have time in the committee to see it as a committee, but if there's some time you're going to be showing it, you know, to members in the House or to other members of the Senate or something like that.
With the permission of the committee, I'd be happy to set up a time. You know, if there's three people, see it, fine. If there's 50, it'd be fine.
I would like to see it too, but as a matter of fact, isn't the Texas system now scandal? Scandal with corruption and all kinds of problems, huh?
I mean, I'm afraid to confess that the average tenure of directors and commissioners of corrections nationwide is 2 years. Texas has had Jim Estelle as director for many years, and I really think he got burned out. But yes, to answer your question, there have been many acts of violence within the correctional system there, which led to his downfall. Ray Pecunier out of New Mexico is now taking it over. He's formerly head of the California system. He's a tough guy, and he is straightening things out. They had corruption among the staff and so on because the system deteriorated. It's unfortunately one of the problems inherent in correctional operations. The stress is very high. The resources are not always there. That's an understatement, I guess. And so these things evolve. What we're trying to do is here, I'm trying to professionalize this operation. So we're putting a lot of emphasis on training. We're trying to boost people up. We're trying to say you are a professional. We expect you to act like one and so on. And that does help. Morale's gone up. We're getting better communication and so on going. But in some of these large departments, those things are almost impossible right now.
One final thought. My wife and I attended the play, the performance at Highland Mountain, Spoon River Anthology, and I don't know who, I guess that's your program. It was really very, very exciting for us to see that, and I commend whoever worked on that.
We're trying to do some other things, too. Maybe Susan could touch on them, but potlatches, for example. We have Fairbanks and Palmer facilities. Been active in that. There was some trouble getting things off the ground, but it looks like those are going to go well. We often are misquoted. For example, some of our inmate population are writing letters to editors and legislators and others saying that half the people in prison are Native. That is not true. It's 35%. The bulk are still Caucasian, with other minorities thrown in. There are allegations that the department is discriminating against Native inmates across the board. I don't feel that that's true either. I'm sure in a department this size, you're going to find individual cases of discrimination, but our people are under very strict instructions to be watching for that kind of thing. So we are the victim often of rumor and other difficulties. We're an easy target because there's a lot of dissatisfied folks that we have to deal with, and occasionally we have incidents, some of them serious, and that's to be expected of any correctional operation anywhere. Well, our job is to keep it to a minimum.
Well, I don't think a correctional officer is any way to run a popularity contest, because most people there, and I'm not happy to be there in the first place. I think that's understandable by most of us. Susan, would you did you have anything you wanted to
else? No, thank you.
For the record, I'm Susan Humphrey Barnett, Director of Statewide Programs for the Department of Corrections. And I know that time is limited, so I'll just run through the areas of my responsibilities and say a quick word about sex offenders, if I may, and then entertain any questions that you have. I'm in charge of mental health programs, sex offender treatment, substance abuse treatment, the community residential centers, which is just another word for halfway houses, education programs, prison industries, chaplaincy program, medical services, domestic violence programs, and planning and research. One point I wanted to kind of reemphasize is that of the increase in sex offenders. We increased about 300 prisoners this year over last year, and a third of those were sex offenders. That's the largest single criminal class we have in prison today. We have approximately 400 sex offenders now, and the number grows literally daily. One thing that's very important with the sex offenders, in particular the child molesters, is that they receive treatment while they're in prison. Child molesters have a very high rate of reoffending without treatment. With treatment, some of the best programs are claiming 12 or 14% recidivism rates, but I think it's fair to liken pedophilia to alcoholism in that once a pedophile, always a pedophile, although you can become a non-offending pedophile with treatment. So when people say treatment doesn't work, that's not necessarily the case. It can work, but I think they're referring to the fact that oftentimes it's not something you are cured of, so to speak. So that a lot of the DAs are saying nowadays that all they're prosecuting are child molesters and DWI cases, and that's definitely what we're seeing, where we're seeing the largest increases. If you would like, I can run through and give you a quick overview of what's available in each of these areas, or if you'd prefer, I'll just entertain any questions you have.
Well, it's a pleasure of the committee. Susan, do you have anything like a synopsis of what's offered it within the prisons for them? You know, like I know I used to go out in Fairbanks to work a little on art and school and stuff. Is there anything that has that spelled out so that
yes,
we
do
save
have a program summary for each institution, which spells out exactly what's available in each institution.
I think a committee would like to have a copy of that.
That will be part of the annual report if it could wait until that's published. If not, we do have it now.
When are you looking at publication?
I think within 3 or 4 weeks.
3 or 4 weeks?
Yeah.
I understand that if a person is convicted and given a sentence of 7 or 8 years, that the time for starting any treatment might be delayed 4 to 5 years after incarceration.
That's correct.
That's probably a limit of limitation of people and money that's at your disposal. Does that delay lead to a less hopeful prognosis than if you could get that person into treatment soon after incarceration?
It would be better if we could get them in sooner. However, if given that the bulk of our sex offenders have 8-year sentences, I wouldn't want them to go start treatment. The average time in treatment is anywhere from 2 to 3 years. I wouldn't want them to start treatment and then languish for 6 years. So in deciding when to offer that treatment, we decided it was better to offer it at the end of the sentence, just prior to their reentry to society.
Is it, if I may pursue this, is it possible within some range of precision for the therapist or others to determine whether or not a course of treatment has succeeded or not?
Yes, starting this month, actually, we're using a device called a plethysmograph, which is monitors arousal levels, and we can actually physically test offenders and see whether or not they're still being aroused by deviant stimuli.
That might be a new industry. what my point is this: if in fact the recovery rate would be greater if the patient were treated earlier upon conviction, and if you can determine if or not that individual offender has his problem under control, given the overcrowding conditions that we were talking to,
presumably sentenced, so we can't.
I understand that, but that's why I'm asking the question. We may be keeping people longer than need be from any point of view.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And it might be more cost effective to have the therapy begin earlier, a determination as to their condition, and if it's a positive determination, to get them out into the community again, rather than do what we're doing under the presumptive sentence law.
I think we would definitely save money. We would need more money in order to get all of the offenders into treatment right away. Right now, some offenders are still getting out without treatment, but the only way we even can approach getting everybody through treatment is by rotating them, is making them wait till their last 3 years and rotating those people into. We only have about 80 beds for sex offender treatment at this time for the 400 offenders.
Why are people getting out without treatment?
They either go into the program, and usually we'll keep them in for between 3 and 6 months even if they're resisting the program, but at some point, if they resist the program, we throw them out because we have so many people waiting. And there are a few people that the judge sentences to less than 2 years, and they don't fit the criteria to get into the program. And for those people, I have been talking to several people in the private sector who are interested in starting outpatient sex offender therapy for those few people that might be appropriate for it. Again, not in lieu of incarceration, but for those people that don't get treatment while they're in jail.
Whose criteria for treatment? Who sets this criteria for treatment?
Right now it's the contractor, and they really don't feel that they can affect any change if they only have somebody for 4 months. It really is a fairly long and in-depth program. Even the outpatient programs are long.
But is it not true that as you work with these individuals, you can see those who have, say, a greater chance of of success in treatment than those that have a lesser chance? Is there any leeway there for those who have the greater chance of possibly making an effect on them to be in these programs?
Yes, and that's really approached by the screening that happens at the very beginning of the program. Those that
then the criteria that's set is not a legal criteria, a court criteria.
No, it's a treatment criteria.
Okay. Madam Chairman, the trouble is that A and B are before the judge. He sentences them both to 8 years. A is very adaptive and responsive to therapy, but waits, but has to wait 4 or 5 years to start. B will never be responsive to therapy. They both get out at the same time. And there's no way to get A into the program earlier and get him back as a taxpayer. Earlier, yes. Under our system.
Obviously, we have glitches in all systems, right? Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, not unless you have particular questions about any of the programs.
Well, if I might, one thing. Are you using, art as a therapeutic tool and theater as a therapeutic tool on a systematic basis or just here and there?
All of the institutions have art programs to one degree or another. A lot of them are concentrating on native arts, but it's not really connected with therapy. It's more connected with the education program.
That's a shame. That's a bias.
Music is the key.
I haven't proved to me it is not. Anybody else have questions or comments? Then, Ms. Tindell, we would certainly be most interested in getting with you to take a further look at alternatives. Susan, appreciate the efforts that are being made in the training and treatment programs, and I think that's where we'll probably find one of our bigger weaknesses as far as court cases. Am I misled in that?
I think that's possible. We've made some tremendous improvements in the last 24 months, but it's just hard to say. The courts have never ruled on what the Constitution means in this state when it says reformation. Does that mean phone calls? Does it mean visits? Does it mean art? What does it mean?
Music.
Hard work.
Is there any work program, for instance, that people can go and hire inmates to work under and check them out for work releases now, or is that all in halfway houses?
It can be done if the work is going to be done for the state or a political subdivision of the state or for a nonprofit agency. You can't, for example, check somebody out to clean your house, but you can certainly we have many work projects where we've helped up in the Palmer area, have done some historical site renovation and quite a few done on the Kenai Peninsula.
I did check out a couple of from a halfway house that worked quite well.
That worked quite well or weren't quite well?
Worked quite well.
Oh, worked quite well.
Good
luck
workers.
Quite well.
Just one quick question. the work release, is this always only on one day at a time?
No, work.
Could it be, well, I guess what I'm getting at, if there's a need, for example, in help in Africa or Peace Corps, whatever, could somebody go for 90 days?
They couldn't go that far away. They can't leave the state, but.
Well, these are people with only a couple months left, I'm talking about.
Well, that you'd be from the halfway houses.
But they may be needed by a nonprofit group elsewhere.
We've had inmates go up and do river, help with river dusting up in Antioch. Yeah, we have, as long as they have to be community custody, which means we feel that they're safe to be in the community, and there has to be a supervisor, and they have to be towards the end of their, within a year of release. But if they meet those criteria,
some of these halfway house people are darn good carpenters and laborers. Ask me. Thank you, Susan. Is there anything else, Mr. Indell, that you'd like to bring before the group? We appreciate your sharing with us. Most of us, I think, except in the case of those who have served formerly on Hess recently, may not be as up to date, and we may have some stupid or not so stupid questions for you as the year goes by. But we do appreciate working with you. And with that, if there's nothing more to come before the committee's adjourned. Thank you.